In this session, we want to do just a little more with Saul. I know you're getting tired of Saul. He's a tiresome person, but we're about done. We want to talk about, we want to look at him from two different angles, and then we'll move on into the rest of 1 Samuel. Of course, Saul will remain a character in the rest of 1 Samuel, but he will not be the main character after chapter 15. The two things I'd like to do in this beginning of this session is to look at the way in which what we have been saying about Saul and the reasons for his rejection, which I hope you're beginning to realize is something of a theological defense of God's rejecting Saul, if we can see the gravity of his offenses. We want to look first at the way in which this picture of Saul that is beginning to emerge is confirmed from the surrounding context. In other words, as we kind of sweep through the story of his rise very quickly, looking particularly at the characterization of Saul or the portrayal of Saul, we will discover that certain dark tones that become increasingly sinister in the life of Saul are present already, okay, in the depiction. And secondly, after we do that, we want also to think a little bit about the way in which what we're saying about Saul is confirmed through his psychological transformation, or the way in which Saul's personality almost seems to change as we read the story. So first of all, the confirmation from the surrounding context. Let's begin way back in chapter 9 very quickly, and I'm just going to highlight certain things, so we're not by any means going to work too tediously through this. But notice first of all what is said when we first meet Saul, and we meet him actually in verse 2, but let's read verses 1 and 2 of chapter 9. There was a Benjamite, a man of standing, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphiah of Benjamin. He had a son named Saul, an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites, a head taller than any others. Now the donkeys. It goes on and talks about the donkeys. No relation there. I mean, that's not part of the characterization by any means. But what strikes you about this introduction to Saul? How does he impress you so far? The description, physical presence. He seems to have had a commanding carriage, probably. He was a head taller than others, and certainly, I guess, tallness, unless it's exorbitantly tall, is not a bad thing. But of course, neither is smallness. But he was impressive. He was an impressive picture of manhood. What's missing? Nothing much about his character. Nothing much about his heart. Nothing much about his fundamental commitments in life. He's just an impressive young man. The Hebrew said he was bahur, which means he was choice. And tov and good, but not good in necessarily in a moral sense or even in an intellectual sense, but good looking. You know, the word is quite general, but he was a good physical specimen. And we're disturbed, however, once we know what Saul turns out to be like, as we kind of reread the story, we sense the lack of the kind of statement that is made, for instance, when David is introduced in chapter 16. It's not his first introduction, but in verse 18 of chapter 16, we have Saul's servants recommending David to him, and they say things like, "I've seen a son of Jesse of Bethlehem who knows how to play the harp. He was gifted. He's a brave man and a warrior. He speaks well and is a fine-looking man." Okay, all these gifts and both physical and in terms of skill and so forth. But then it says, "And the Lord is with him." Okay, now earlier God had said to Samuel, man looks at the outward appearance, God looks at the heart. And so, though it didn't perhaps perplex us when we first read it, once you know how Saul began to develop, it is vaguely unsettling when you go back and read his introduction and suddenly realize it's purely external. It's just talking about the outward appearance and nothing at all about the heart. Yes, question over here. Right, right. Okay, yeah, the comment is that often if if you're simply told, you know, this person is from this family and went to these schools, and you tell about their lineage and so forth, which is what we're reading about here, it doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the character of that particular individual. You know, to say he is a Rockefeller or something means that he's probably got money, but it doesn't say a thing about what kind of person he is, whether he's the kind of person you'd really want to know or would be able to appreciate or become friends with or anything else. Yes, another question. Okay. Yeah, the comment, I'm sorry, I can't let the video watchers miss it. He said, in his version, his translation, it says, from his shoulders upward, he was taller than other people, and it sounds like he had a big head. Well, I will say this, that'll preach, but I'm not sure that's how we could construe the idiom, actually, but it'll preach even as comic relief, probably. Yes, William. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, the comment really has to do with the fact that Saul often is expresses himself in relation to the people, and that does sort of set the tone for what we later find, as in chapter 15, for instance, Saul confesses to having obeyed the people. I listened to the people rather than to God. Well, let's don't jump too far ahead, because we want to kind of wade through it and pick up these details in the order in which they're given. Yeah, Bill. Yeah, it is. It is. Well, I would to use a fancy word, I would take the second clause as epexegetical, which means explanatory, of saying, lest you get this wrong, we're talking about his impressive physical presence. He was without equal. He was choice and good-looking without equal. In fact, he was a head taller than anyone else. I would construe it that way. Okay. Well, let's go on, and as he gets into chapter 9, remember the episode recounts how he was sent by his father to go search for some lost livestock, some lost donkeys, and eventually Saul, who is not, you know, don't think of Saul as a sinister guy. He was probably a pretty decent fellow, okay? As indeed there are many decent fellows who are also unbelievers, and that unbelief will be their downfall in an ultimate sense, but it doesn't mean that he wouldn't have been a kind of guy you would have liked, perhaps. And he certainly seemed to be concerned for his father's concerns and such. As a dutiful son, he goes off looking for the livestock, trying to fulfill his assignment. They don't find them, and it says in verse 5, when they reached the district of Zuf, Saul said to the servant who was with him, "Come, let's go back, or my father will stop thinking about the donkeys and start worrying about us." You know, he's the good son who's out beyond curfew, and he thinks, my parents are going to be worrying. We really should get home. You know, I know it'd be fun to go to Pizza Hut, but I got to get home, or my parents are going to... He cares about what his father thinks. And so we don't want to paint him in completely negative terms. He's probably a good kind of dutiful son. But the servant then says, now look, in this town, there is a man of God. He is highly respected. He is heavy. He is kaved. Okay? He is heavy. He's highly respected. And everything he says comes true. Let's go there now. Perhaps he will tell us what way to take. Now, the servant here begins to take the lead, because apparently Saul doesn't know this, or it doesn't dawn on Saul, but the servant is aware, hey, there's a man of God here. Okay. Again, I think that's a very subtle hint that something is perhaps amiss in Saul. Whereas the servant is aware of a man of God and values what the man of God might have to say, Saul seems to be oblivious to it. Now, again, he's not a bad guy. He doesn't resist it. He does have a problem. He says in verse 7, "Well, if we go, what can we give the man? The food in our sacks is gone. We have no gift to take to the man of God. What do we have?" Now, that may betray a deficient understanding of the way prophets in Israel functioned. Prophets in Israel were often offered gifts, but in the biblical accounts that we have of them, there's only one instance where I think it was Elisha actually accepted a gift, but that was to distribute it to the people. Okay? By and large, Israel's prophets did not prophesy for profit. P-R-O-F-I-T. They didn't prophesy for money. Now, it was typical in surrounding nations that you would bring payment with you, you know, and you'd kind of buy the oracle. But that was not typical in Israel. So it may betray a deficient understanding, although the servant goes along with it and says, look, he said, I have a quarter of a shekel of silver. Okay, I have in my hand. I will give it to him. I will give it to the man of God so that he will tell us what way to take. And then in verse 9 it explains the terminology. Formerly in Israel, if a man went to inquire of God, he would say, come, let us go to the seer, because the prophet of today used to be called a seer. Very interesting sort of footnote placed in the text to let us know that there was some time lag between the events and the recording of this event in written form, at least. So there needs to kind of update the terminology. So Saul says, good, come, let's go. So they set out for the town where the man of God was. As they were going up the hill to the town, they met some girls coming out to draw water, and they asked them, is the seer here? He is, they answered. He's ahead of you. Hurry now. He has just come to our town today, for the people have a sacrifice at the high place. Now, it's real interesting, just to give you a little sidelight. The Hebrew of that that verse 12 there is really kind of confused, to the extent that many commentators have sought to reconstruct the wording and make it make good grammatical sense. But again, with a better literary approach, a better literary sense of how to read these texts, you begin to realize that what is being depicted there is the excitement, the agitation of these young maidens who've come to the well, and they have this guy without equal. You know, I don't know what kind of guy you would deem to be the kind of guy you'd be really impressed, you women in the class, to meet at the well. But this was the kind of guy that they were impressed to meet. And I think they were excited. And I think they were stumbling over themselves. And I think the Hebrew narrator had the good sense to depict it that way. They didn't complete their sentences. They have, you know, they run into each other as they're trying to say, he's here. You'll get there. You know, get on up there. And you'll meet him just as he's coming into town. And so they prepare him. As soon as you enter the town, verse 13, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. The people will not begin eating until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Maybe a little preview of later problems. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Go up now. You will find him about this time. Now, who's the prophet? Samuel. Now, how do you know that? The title of the book is 1 Samuel, so that's how we know that. No. But let's imagine you haven't read the rest of the story and you don't know the English title of the book. How would you know? Are there hints here already that Samuel is the prophet? We're not told. How do you know that Samuel's the prophet? Yeah, Dwayne. They're using, I think, that word heavy in the sense of honored, highly respected in this case. There are a couple of hints that are a little more direct even than that. Where are they? Where are Saul and his servant right now? Verse 5. They reached the district of Tzuf, right? Have you heard that word before? Those of you with photographic memories? What about the first verse of the book? There was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Tzufite from the hill country of Ephraim. Who was that man? Elkanah. Whose father was he? Samuel. Now, Samuel was born in the district of Tzuf. He was a Tzufite. He lived there. His hometown was Ramah. So, in a subtle way, if you knew the geography and such, as you read here, you would begin to think, oh, this is Samuel. They didn't give his name, but this is Samuel. Another? Is there another? Yes, William? Exactly. Yeah, that is correct. The point being made is, there's a reference in chapter 3, at the end, I think it is, 19, the Lord was with Samuel as he grew up, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And we are reminded of that when we read in chapter 9, verse 6, he is highly respected and everything he says comes true. Synonymous expressions, really. Not identical, but synonymous, saying the same thing. His word is authoritative. God is with him. Okay? So in several different ways, we are alerted to the fact that this is Samuel. So, why do you think the narrator didn't just say Samuel was in this town? Now, we will eventually be told. We get to verse 15. It says, now the day before Samuel came, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel. So we discover at that point, oh yeah, it is Samuel. We've been guessing that all along. Why might the narrator have withheld the name of Samuel to this point in the narrative? Again, that's too hard a question for me to really pose and expect you to answer. So let me contrast two different perspectives. The one critical approach to these texts has been to say, really what we have here is the combination of two originally independent stories. One is about an anonymous seer in the district of Tsuf, and the other is about Samuel. And these have been combined together in an artificial fashion so that we wouldn't really trust them as telling what really happened. Okay, now there's another way to read this. The way I would suggest reading it is that the narrator intentionally withholds the name of Samuel explicitly, but gives us sufficient hints that if we're attentive, we begin to say, Tsuf, okay, not one of his words falls to the ground. Everything he says comes true. Oh, this must be Samuel. And we've already figured out it's Samuel, especially by the time verse 15 rolls around and we're told that this is Samuel. Now, Saul has been alerted to the presence of the seer. He's been told by the maidens exactly where he will find him. As you enter the town, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. You know, just as you enter the town, you'll find him. He's there. Now, what does Saul do in verse 18? In verse 17, Samuel caught sight of Saul, and the Lord confirms, "This is the man I spoke to you about. He will govern my people." Saul approached Samuel in the gateway and asked, "Excuse me, would you please tell me where the seer's house is?" Now, again, this is a very subtle thing, but what is that? What impression does that give us of Saul? Big but dumb. You know, I mean, he was, to put it, okay, yeah, God is working in Samuel's heart and saying, you know, this is the man, this and that. And Saul has the benefit of these excited young maidens who said, you'll find him just as you enter the city. There's where he'll be there. You'll run into him. You'll find him. And he runs right into him. He says, excuse me, could you tell me where the, you know, and it's not the servant, it's Saul who makes that mistake. And the reader, who has rather quickly and rather easily figured out that this is Samuel, as we kind of reread the text, thinks, well, is Saul really with it? Is he really catching what's being said? Is he attentive or not? Now again, it's the kind of subtlety that would pass us by on a first reading, but if you know the end of the story and how things develop, then you go back and you reread it and you think, well, yeah, maybe there is something to that. Now we move on to chapter 10, which was the anointing scene. We've already sort of alluded to this. When the third sign is fulfilled, someone mentioned in the previously the reaction of the bystanders. The third sign is fulfilled. Saul is prophesying among them. And what is it that those who had known Saul formerly asked? They see Saul out with these, you know, it's kind of like he's out with Campus Crusade or something. You know, and they say, he's out there in the mall witnessing? What's happened to Saul? You know, what has happened to the son of Kish? The last place we would have expected him to be. Now, again, that's, people try to interpret that different ways and say, well, no, the prophets were viewed as madmen. And so they're wondering what happened to this normally sane person that he's mixing in with these rabble-rousers, these madmen. Well, some characters in the Bible do refer to some prophets as madmen, but that's more a reflection of their perspective. In the Bible, generally, surely, true prophets were highly esteemed. And so for Saul to fall in with the prophets was a positive thing, but it surprised those who had known him formerly. And again, that's a subtle hint that perhaps not all is well with Saul. It's kind of like, if I can put it this boldly, we've known him to be an unbeliever, a secular guy. What's he doing out there with those religious folk? And that's when the second bystander says, well, just who is their father? You know, which could mean, remember, it's not a hereditary thing. You know, you're not born a believer. Maybe Saul's come to believe. That could be what they're asking. Or they could be saying, maybe we better check out this group. Who's their leader? Who's their father? Maybe the group is suspect if Saul's amongst them. Either way, again, another unsettling sort of confirmation that not all is not well, even in this so-called early phase. Well, then we came to the lot casting episode. And again, we've talked about it already, so I'll just hit on it briefly. When Saul is found, ultimately, the lot lands upon him. He can't be found. They inquire of God again. God says he's hiding behind the baggage. Now, the standard interpretation, as I've mentioned before, is that this is evidence of Saul's laudable, praiseworthy humility. On the verge of greatness, knowing that he had been selected, he nevertheless was self-effacing and withdrew from that great honor. And that's one reading, but I don't think it's a plausible reading in the light of all else that's happening in these texts. The better reading, I think, is that this is an example of Saul's faltering, Saul's timidity, Saul's fear in the face of challenge. And it's not so much that he denied himself the honor. He denied his calling that God had placed upon him and assured him of and charged him to fulfill. And so he's dragged out, and though the troublemaker's comment was not good because God had chosen Saul, still there was some truth to their dissatisfaction. They said, how can this guy save us? You know, a hiding giant, giant though he be, he's cringing in fear behind the baggage. We're not impressed. Yeah, Dave. Oh, right. Yeah, I skipped right over that one, in fact. Yeah, I'm sorry. I skipped right over that one, which is in my notes. Before you get to the lot casting procedure in verses 14 to 16 of chapter 10, when he gets into that little interesting conversation with his uncle. And the uncle is very curious when he hears that Saul has encountered Samuel. And he said, what did Samuel tell you? And Saul says, as I mentioned last time, Saul says, the donkeys were found. Okay, you know, thank you. That's really enlightening. That was certainly the main event, you know. And the narrator points out he didn't even mention the kingship. Again, that is typically, traditionally interpreted as a sign of Saul's humility. How amazing, you know. He had been chosen. He had been elected president of the student body, and he didn't even tell his uncle. Maybe if the president of the student body has a duty to fulfill and he hasn't done it, and the uncle might tend to kick him into action, maybe he didn't mention it because he was feeling like his hour had come and he had not grasped the opportunity. So again, I would see that as a sign of Saul's faltering, his hesitance to do the will of God. Okay, then we come to jumping over to chapter 11. First, a comment, a question here for you. The question is, can you take chapter 10, verse 11, as an indication that the seer and Samuel were different people? You'll have to elaborate on what you mean there.
Yes.
Okay, well, yeah, but in this instance, see, Samuel, you might need to go back and reread this. Samuel, in chapter 10, tells Saul, as part of the third sign, Saul will encounter a different group, a group of prophets coming down from the high place. So Samuel won't be involved in that aspect. Okay, it'll be a different group of prophets. So I don't think that would have a bearing on whether the seer was Samuel or not. Yeah, Bishop. Yeah. Yeah. Right. The question is, did Saul simply falter? Was it, in a sense, a sin of weakness that he didn't get on with it? Or was it truly a sin of unbelief that he just thought, you know, say what you will, Samuel, I'll do what's necessary in the situation? Again, I never summarize these questions as well as they're put, but that's the gist of it, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I would see it as failures stemming from unbelief, not weak belief. You know, because God is very gracious towards our weaknesses. You know, He is patient with us in our weakness, and though we are faithless, He remains faithful. But unbelief is a different thing. You know, unbelief is an entirely different thing, and I think that is the problem here. That Saul will go through the motions so long as it's convenient and expedient and serves the situation, but he doesn't have any fundamental belief that everything rides on what God is doing in the situation. Again, that seems to be the case from what we read. Well, in chapter 11, just rushing on here, in chapter 11, the messengers who are sent from Jabesh-Gilead by the elders who are threatened come to Gibeah. Now, I've argued that in my green book here, the camouflage book there, that the text really would suggest that the messengers came directly to Gibeah. Now, though they say to Nahash, give us 7 days so we can send messengers throughout Israel. If no one comes to rescue us, we will surrender to you. We need to remember that they're talking to their enemy, the enemy that's threatening them and wants to pluck out the right eye of all their warriors and such. And so they're saying, give us some time. Maybe we can raise a savior from the land of Israel. And so confident is Nahash that he says, fine, you've got 7 days, see what you can find. But then the text says the messengers went to Gibeah, which I think means that they knew Saul's the choice. Saul's the one. He's the one who was selected by Lot, and cringing though he was behind the baggage, we got to go to him. Because it says the messengers went to him. In the NIV it says when the messengers came to Gibeah, and that's a possible translation, but when is not necessary. It's not mandatory that you translate the Hebrew that way. It's just the messengers, and then the messengers came to Gibeah. Okay? And what was the response of the inhabitants when they saw that people had come to Saul, to the city of Saul for rescue? They wept. See, they knew him best. And they thought, okay, if you've come to us for help, good luck to you. And they wept, but God came upon Saul in power, and he burned with anger, and he chopped up those oxen with which he had been plowing. Now remember, he had been set aside to be king, gone back to farming. He chopped up those oxen and sent them out in judges-like fashion. Remember last time again, I talked about Judges 19, and the way this is reminiscent of a time when there was no king in Israel. Now Saul, was supposed to get to the throne by demonstrating, and he had failed to do what his hand found to do. And so it's almost as if there's no king in Israel. The process was started, but through Saul's faltering, it never got anywhere. He's still not on the throne. He's gone back to farming. Okay, and so he's even behaving like the Levite in Judges 19, dividing up the parts and sending them to all Israel. Eventually, however, immediately the people come out in mass, and Saul does win a great victory. And the kingship is renewed at the end of chapter 11. We've talked all about this, so I won't go over it again. Chapter 12 emphasizes that there's a test still to be stood. And then we get into chapter 13, which we've talked about at length. Now, the reason I go back over that one more time is just to help you get the picture and help you to see the way in which biblical narrators, particularly in Samuel, but also in Kings and the story of Solomon that we'll get to later in this course, biblical narrators sometimes convey their messages through subtleties. Now, they also provide enough significant guideposts that we are driven along the right road. You don't have to be a genius to get the point, and you certainly don't have to read Hebrew to get the point. But they are very gifted, as you would expect from an inspired writer. They are gifted narrative artists, and close attention to detail in the texts is rewarded. You do understand more fully what was going on in these stories and in these histories and in the lives of the characters by paying close attention even to the details and reading and rereading the text. You almost always pick up something new. So I would conclude in terms of the surrounding context that our argument, which I've now erased, that Saul's fundamental problem was a fundamental unbelief which led to various kinds of disobedience. The general problem was he simply didn't obey God because he didn't really believe that obeying God was all that important. And so he disobeyed in various ways, and thus the surface offenses were things like not waiting for Samuel, going ahead with the sacrifices, failing to execute Agag as commanded, and those kinds of things. Yes, Mark. Yeah, and the question is he all that different from other great men of faith who also hesitated when they were called? Gideon, for example, Moses, for example, the others that you mentioned. In that respect, no. It's appropriate when you are called upon to do something great, and God says, I want you to teach that, your women in the church Bible study, that gathering of 80 women. I want you to be the one to teach this semester, and you're terrified and you say, me? Are you kidding? I'm not the one for that. If God then confirms to you that it's right that you feel inadequate, but you're my choice, then it becomes culpable for you to hang back and say, well, I just won't do it. I'm not capable of it. Well, God knows you're not capable of it. None of us are capable of any good thing. He will do it if He calls us. Okay? Now, in Moses' case, he hesitated and hesitated. And he said, I can't talk. And God said, oh, brilliant. You know, who made man's mouth? You think I can't give you the ability to speak if I call upon you to do it? And Moses continued to hesitate until God became angry with Moses. But he didn't reject him. And a lot of it, the difference between Saul and those great men of God is how they responded to what happened in their lives. And that brings me to the last point, and that is, how does what we're saying about Saul and his unbelief, how is that confirmed through the rest of the story of Saul, the transformation we see in Saul? And let me draw a little chart up here on the board, see if this makes any sense. Sometimes writers will talk about the difference between good faith and bad faith, both of which are to be distinguished from true faith or real faith. I mean, good faith means that you're doing the best you can and you have a good will and you're trying to do right. Bad faith means that you're malicious and meaning to misbehave and you don't want to do right. Okay? Now, let's make that one axis of our diagram. Let's make the other axis ignorance or lack of knowledge. Ignorance, and then let's make this knowledge. Because we see in Saul a growth in knowledge, and I think a decline from good faith to increasing bad faith. All right? As in the early stages, it may be that Saul just doesn't get it. You know, for eyes that are not opened spiritually, then they may not see the significance of that first charge that Samuel gave. You know, and he may in chapter 13 be legitimately surprised. Samuel, why are you so angry? Well, I mean, or why are you so upset? We don't know that Samuel was angry because we don't know the intonation. When he said, what have you done? You've acted foolishly. He may have been pleading with him. What's wrong, Saul? You know, Saul, get a clue. But and Saul may have said, well, you know, I pulled myself together. Everybody else was fleeing. You know, what's the deal? I was acting in good faith. But then Samuel made it increasingly clear what was required of Saul. You know, Saul, listen and obey what God says. You know, and as he made it more and more clear, we see that Saul's good faith began to wane as his knowledge increased. So, in fact, the direction in Saul's experience is this way. An inverse relationship between good faith and knowledge. The more knowledge, the more Saul understands what's involved, the less willing he is to go along with it. Now think for a minute as kind of an adjunct to this. Think for a minute the major character trait we see in Saul when he is faced with those initial challenges. What is his reaction to those initial challenges? Before he experiences any military success, what is his chief characteristic? Fear. Fear? Timidity, panic. He's paralyzed. He's hiding. You know, we don't want to be too fanciful about it. But he's afraid. Now, what is the root cause of his fear? Or think about the challenges you face in life. Okay? What is the root cause of your fear in the face of those challenges? Or to put it more positively, what is it that enables you to face those challenges without overwhelming fear? Faith, okay? The knowledge that God is there, and as I face those challenges, He is there for me. I don't face them alone. But if God is not there, I sometimes ask myself, I don't know how unbelievers, non-Christians, I don't know how they face a day in this life. You know, you don't know when you get up in the morning whether your family whom you love will be there that night. You know, there's so much you don't know. How do you face that if it's all just chance? You know, anything can happen any day. How in the world do unbelievers... I admire their ability to go through days and not just end it all, because they are without hope. You know, life is terrifying if God is not in control. But because God is in control, we can face those challenges in our lives. And, you know, there are a lot of minor challenges, you know, like you've got to get up you guys, or some of you who are preaching sermons, you know, you've got to get up and preach your first sermon, or you've got to make a presentation at work and you've never done that before and you're terrified to get up in front of people, or you've got to do any number of other things that are frightening. But the reason you're not paralyzed with fear is you say, well, you know, I'm going to trust God with this. Doesn't mean that you have no natural fear. You're still a little anxious, but the bedrock is God is there. All right. Saul's paralyzing fear, I think, confirmed the fact that he was an unbeliever. God was not a reality for Saul. No source of strength when he faced those challenges. Now, notice, however, what happened to Saul when he began to experience his successes. What transformation in his personality took place? He became prideful. He became arrogant. And he would, you know, he would kind of flip-flop back and forth. If that threat was removed and the people began to say, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s, Saul was peeved. Saul was jealous because of his pride. Now, what is the source of pride in our lives? Let's say you've just accomplished some great task, you know, that no one thought you could do, and you did it. And you're overweening in your pride. What's the problem? Yeah, you think that you did it. Again, God is not a reality for you. You don't give credit where credit is due. So, for a believer, the fear of the challenge is mitigated by a knowledge that God is there. God will bring me through it. God will help me in it. And likewise, the temptation to pride should be dashed by the recognition that I didn't do that. God did that. He could have used someone else. He could have used anyone else. And it wasn't anything in me that got that accomplished. You know. But if God is not a reality for you, you're going to be going from fear to pride to fear to pride. And it's the same malady that is expressed in both phases of Saul's life. In the early phase, we see more of the fear. In the later phase, we see more of the pride and of the unwillingness to submit to the will of God and the insistence that he's going to kill David and thus maintain his power. Okay, comments or questions? That's all I'm going to say on Saul. But it's kind of fun for me to do it. I hope you get something out of it. But it's fun for me to do it because so often the kind of work you do when you're writing a doctoral dissertation is so esoteric that it's of no earthly value, or it seems that it's of no earthly value, and it doesn't really ever come down to earth. And I'm very grateful to God that in a way I feel like I learned something valuable working on Saul, who was a puzzle to me and perplexing to me. But by studying it, it confirmed to me that, you know, the God's Word does make sense. Everyone was saying the story doesn't make sense, so it's got to be a mixture of all these conflicting sources. It really does make sense. And also, God is just. You know, until I really understood what was wrong with Saul, he bothered me because I thought, you know, when am I going to do that little dumb thing? And God's going to say, well, that's it. You know, last straw. You know, you're out. You're gone. And I realized Saul was never in. Saul wasn't one of God's people. God doesn't deal with his children that way. And so it's a comfort theologically to clarify that. Now, any comments or questions? Yeah, Jennifer. Yeah. Yeah, the question is, as Saul kind of becomes increasingly insane, you know, and is involved in this downward spiral, is this God judging Saul repeatedly, or is it just an exhibition of what Saul is really like? I think that the path that we see Saul taking is the path of a man without God. You know, in difficult circumstances, a person without God. And that's the natural path that we would all take. You know, we would all become increasingly bitter, withdrawn, alienated. I mean, that's the nature of life. If you're placed in a pressure cooker. Now, there's some people that live their lives and they're pretty nice and decent and kind and reasonably good and so forth. And they're unbelievers. And sometimes we wonder, how can that be? So, you know, some unbelievers are so much nicer than believers. The problem is, they're nice because they want to be nice. They're nice because they feel good being nice. It pleases them to be nice. But the Bible says we've all fallen short of the glory of God. We all fall short of glorifying God. Good illustration of that, and we'll move into our break after this. One that our pastor, Rodney Storch, uses sometimes is that he was driving along on the freeway, and I think he was clocking about 65 in a 55-mile-an-hour zone, and he saw some church member, I think. I'm kind of filling in the details. He passed a church member who was only going 55, and he thought, oh dear, I better slow down and fall in behind this church member who is law-abiding, okay, who is glorifying the law, you see, regarding the law as he should. And so the pastor drops in behind and is clocking 55, being a good little boy. And then they both take the same exit. And as they take the same exit, his good example, whom he was following, continues to do 55. It's a 35-mile-an-hour zone. He's still going 55. And suddenly, Rodney realizes, or the pastor realizes, he was going 55 not because he was glorifying the law, but because he likes going 55, whatever the circumstances, okay? And sometimes when we look at unbelievers and say, they're nicer than I am, you know, they're better than I am, they're kind and they're good and so forth, they're that way because it pleases them. That's the way they want to be, and it pleases other people. But there's still a sense of falling short of glorifying God, which is where we all are. You know, it's not that we are worse people. But we're sinners saved by grace. Now, we're getting into a lot of theology, and I see a few furrowed brows, but I think we better take our break, and I'm going to give you just a short break, 7 minutes, okay? When the big hand reaches the two, okay? When the big hand reaches the two, let's reconvene.